It's run like a government.
Right.
You know, they're great people. But I was in a letter where about 3 weeks ago, after a meeting we had in Boston, and I said, I think we need to have more knowledge of what's going on in the other groups in the hydrogen economy,
mm-hmm.
so that the left hand needs to know what the right hand is doing. I said, I do not think you are making full use of the technical manpower that we have. I'll just see if I can show you a couple of I'll be right back.
Okay.
I'm feeding in the state of our comment since I thought our thoughts might be of interest to you and possibly others involved in the DOE hydrogen program. Yet the present time, the overall hydrogen is not as productive as it might be. All persons involved in different DOE programs need to be informed, updated concerning the possibly changing specific objectives, success, and problems in each of the programs. Programs of the two are production of hydrogen by different methods, storage of hydrogen by different methods, including liberation of hydrogen from its stored state methods of using hydrogen. The full intellectual capacity of all scientists involved in the hydrogen framework is not now fully exploited. Collaborative work overlapping the above 1, 2, 3 aspects should be encouraged. To avoid working in a box, a one-hour lecture should be presented at the beginning of each center meeting, group meeting summarizing most important successes, problems, including cost, new possible lines of attack in each of the three areas. This would serve a different purpose, different from the presentation of numerous detailed research programs, which are also extremely important. This approach would stimulate cross-fertilization of ideas between persons who are officially engaged in different specific problem areas, blah, blah, blah. I feel there's too much control being run sort of like machinery.
Mm-hmm.
Open up, talk, stimulate new ideas or approach. Whereas ONR and AFSOR and DOD, those three organizations will run very similarly. Because DOE has problems that the government is at the moment is reducing the budget at the time when we need the more money. They're reducing it by imposing taxes. The DOE will give a certain, will have a certain amount of budget, and then the government taxes the budget to pay for the hurricanes and the Iraqi war. So it's sort of interesting, the budget is not touched. They're purely the tax, there are taxes added, government taxes added to the government budget. So one of the reasons I'm really finding other countries very much more forward-looking in certain ways that I feel are important, perhaps one week so.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that your original contact with Heger had come through the Material Science Library. Is that what's now LRSN?
LRSN, that's right.
Can you tell me a little about your involvement with the origins of that institution and
of LRSM.
Mm-hmm.
That started now, I guess it was about 38 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it says Laboratory for Research on the Structure of Matter. Now, Bob Hughes, who was a senior member of the chemistry department at that time, was an X-ray crystallographer. I was just a very junior member. And I thought a synthesis would be better, but he said, no, the structure is the important thing. So it was called the laboratory for the structure.
Being a crystallographer, right?
So I lost out. But so it is now called LRSM, Laboratory Research on Structured Matter, although it's more frequently called Material Science Laboratory. And it's been funded periodically by ARPA and by DARPA and now by NSF. Mm-hmm. The main method of operation has remained the same. There's the director, the executive committee, central facilities. Feed programs and more specific projected programs. In general, I think the concept is great. In order to put in a proposal to be funded, then individual faculty members from either the same or different departments will put in a joint proposal where it is showing work which could not be easily done by the individual person alone, but can be done by a collaborative approach. We're using the concept 1 + 1 = 2.
Right.
Also, they have a program for a seed program for completely new concepts, which can be an individual or group of individuals for a 1 year period, just to sort of see if something flies. Also, there's a very strong outreach branch of the program, which we have had one very active one in Puerto Rico. And for underprivileged people, Afro-Americans, women, people of Spanish descent. So the outreach program is a very, very important aspect of this. So I think the overall program is great. Anything can be improved, but overall I think it is great.
You talked about Penn being this kind of elephant. How did this elephant kind of lumber towards this, interdisciplinary sort of cutting edge?
Well, it started off as interdisciplinary, and just from memory, I think it started about 38 years ago. That Bob Hughes and a couple of other people had heard that there could be money available for a building on material science. Of course, material science 40 years ago was a buzzword,
right?
A real sexy word. Just as then nano science became the sexy word, and now energy is becoming the sexy word.
Mm-hmm.
So I think then they put in a proposal, which was then it was DARPA or ARPA at that time, said, well, tell us more, and more came, and the money came through, and the university was very happy to be part of that. So I think here it started from memory, as I say, 38 years ago.
Right.
From a group of interested persons taking up on some calls for thoughts and ideas from, I think, was DARPA.
What made things click with you and Heger when you heard each other's presentations?
We were working on silicon compounds at that time, some of which had an overall spherical symmetry. So I said to Alan at the coffee break, this practice sessions, which all of us loathe, terrible, but turned out to be extremely important to have a practice session. So the left hand knows what the right hand is doing in different departments. So I said, we have these things that paramate that, I wonder if they could be conducting. And I said, that's spherical. I said, no, you don't want a spherical thing if we're being conducting. You want things that are sort of linear, two-dimensional, not three-dimensional. And then he said, maybe we'll talk about it sometime. Mm-hmm. And so he came across, it was getting dark, about like this, and we're sitting in my office right there. And then he said, there's some interesting work that has come out by what Labies at Temple University, SNX, and it's fairly highly conducting. And I said, what do you mean, SNX? But everyone knows tin's a metal. and I actually had that sure. in this thing right. here. Because it needs to write it down to see it. I won't find it. Yeah, right. So, on one occasion, he came to my office and informed me that Mort Labies was principally a highly conducting material. I say that pointedly applied SNX, being an inorganic chemist. I wrote down the piece of paper. As I say there, SNX, and said, of course, you expect it to be conducting, it's a metal, to which he replied and paid, no, not SNX, but SNX. And that happened right at that desk at about this time of night. So that's how we got started.
What intrigued you enough about this to begin moving your research program into this area?
Many of the heat events said, this is again learning each other's scientific language. I told them that I had made the precursor to SNX as well as to do my industry. And they asked me if I could make some SNX for ultimately successful and take part from the year. When he first said this to me, I said, no. We'd have to use a vac system, and vac systems are like toothbrushes. You don't change them. Once you put one chemical in them, it can contaminate the whole thing.
And you might tell me, I'm sorry, I have to interrupt.
Yeah.
Do you still need anything?
No, I think this is just great.
So if it's okay, then...
Okay, jolly good. We can finish off that lesson in the morning.
Okay, yes, I'll put it on your chair.
Okay,
yeah.
Jolly good.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Say hi to all the kids.
Yeah, okay, and I'll see how Katie's doing.
Okay, great, yeah. Wonderful.
Okay, see you.
And you've left that on the chair.
Yes, okay. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all.
See you.
Thanks, Becky. See you in the morning.
Yeah.
Great.
Tomorrow you have nothing.
Oh, shucks, yeah. So that's how Hugo and I got together.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
Well, you were talking about the vacuum system.
Finally, instead of having the vacuum light system right in again, I said, could you just try it just once? And the postdoc, Chester Mikorski, is working on some silicon chemistry, tried it once, and the first time worked beautifully, got beautiful golden crystals. And then we tried it again, we went on for about 3 months, and we couldn't reproduce it, and I thought, you know, this moonlighting, and he's being paid to do, being doing silicon chemistry, and not going to have anybody to put in a proposal, the research results. Then finally, he's able to get some more of these golden SMH crystals.
Mm-hmm. So were you producing them for Heger at that point, or were you actually interested in them for yourself?
No, at first I was just doing them a favor.
Mm-hmm.
Of course I was interested to really see whether they were highly conducting, because what Levy's in his paper had said that he had conductivities varying all over the place, his work, and he had, they were not analytically pure. So then I thought, well, you know, with elemental analyses, they were not pure by doing elemental analysis. So it's like the old story that physical chemists do very accurate physical studies on impure materials. Synthetic chemists do very inaccurate physical studies on very pure materials. So this was sort of intriguing. Since I'd worked on the sulfur nitrate stuff, the tetramer before, so I thought, you know, using the polymer, just
mm-hmm.
And then when we got the, they looked so pretty,
uh-huh.
And the color has really been the driving force in my life, is color.
So at what point then did you become interested in the sulfur nitride yourself as the main area of your research?
This was of course a follow through from the work that I did as a lab boy,
mm-hmm.
from S4, N4, the SN four times the tetramer,
right.
Which I then did my master's thesis on in New Zealand, and then put it aside for 20 odd years, and then when I saw these golden crystals at the first time around.
But I mean, you know, after having made these for Heger, at what point did you become interested in yourself?
Oh no, I love the color.
Uh-huh.
That was just great. Looks like crystals of gold.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I just got intrigued by the fact that the stuff that I'd worked on, the tetramer. Oh, I might mention that the SNX was not a new compound being made by Margaret Becker-Goring in Heidelberg in the early 1950s.
Uh-huh.
So that I was trying to reproduce her reaction conditions that she had published.
Mm-hmm.
And as a synthetic chemist, one sort of takes an innate pride in being able to, if somebody else has published something, to be able to show that you can reproduce their work. And if you can't reproduce their work, are they wrong or am I wrong?
Right.
But it's very interesting how different fads and fashions arise. That Margaret Becker-Goring in the early 1950s came out with this highly conducting stuff. She said it was highly conducting. But the world was not prepared for it. It was not thinking of highly conducting things in those days. And so it laid dead until Mort Levy is about, must have been about 10 or 15 years later, decided to try and reproduce her work, and finally got results of chemical purity all over the place and conductivities all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then, since I'd worked on the tetramer in New Zealand, I thought, well, this is interesting. When I saw these bright, shiny golden crystals, I thought, you know, this was very, very intriguing.
And it was as much a sort of personal challenge of
That is right. Uh-huh. It was really a personal challenge. As synthetic chemist, Margaret Becker-Goring in Heidelberg had a very good reputation. Mort Levy's had gotten all of these varying results.
Mm-hmm.
so I thought, well, Blandell is a synthetic chemist. I should be able to solve this, or at least clarify the situation between these two groups of workers. Particularly since I'd worked on the Tetchener earlier. So I thought, okay, well, you know, here's a challenge. Two different groups of people, different countries, separated by 10 to 20 years, are getting different types of results. So can I jump in the middle and see, which is, do I get one sort of result that what ladies get, sort of the sort of result that Margaret Becky Goring gets?
Right.
It was a challenge, a sort of an intellectual challenge. And once I saw these pretty colors, I thought, oh boy, this is fun.
Did you kind of start to put the silicon hydride work behind you, or did that continue along for a while?
No, the hydride work would actually, when they came from Cambridge, the hydride work, and then we started looking at silicon attached to metal, transition metal carbonyls. And then we've done things like trimethyl silane cobalt tetracarbonyl. And these were in the days that organometallic compounds in metal carbonyls were arousing a lot of interest. So started off silicon hydride work, and then the transition metal carbonyls were arousing more and more interest as possible catalysts, etc. So then they made things like carbon CH3 cobalt tetracarbonyl.
Right.
So then thought, well, what about making silicon SiH3 cobalt tetracarbonyl and iron carbonyl derivatives? But since it was much easier to work with the hydrogens being replaced by organic groups, they're using trimethyl silyl instead of silyl with SiH3 to use 3-methyl Si with a methyl group replacing each hydrogen, to have that attached. And so we published some papers on silicon transition metal carbonyl species.
Mm-hmm. You talked about color. Were any of those compounds
Yes,
colored?
All of the carbonyls were colored. Right.
Right.
So color has driven me a lot.
Yeah.
I like pretty things.
But then did the, once you'd begun the SNX work, did the silicon work kind of peter off?
Yeah, that is right. They got more and more interested in the SNX.
Right.
But then with this silent electric discharge, the ozonizer effect.
It came back.
As a matter of fact, one of the things I was stressing in Brazil is the following, which is a principle really want to push very much more, and that is going back to some of the old literature. It is fascinating. Now that is this. Now this goes back to high school chemistry. That in any chemical reaction, you can have, say, A plus B gives products, and you have to get over an activation energy heat peak. And if you're dealing with an exothermic reaction, it gives out heat. And let's take one, this oxygen-hydrogen fuel cell, then that finishes up with H2O, and we say anything that burns in the air is thermodynamically unstable in the air, and therefore, will react. You can take care of the kinetics, and will then release energy either as heat, light, electricity, or a combination. So this is high school chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the other things we know that alcohol burns in the air, therefore it's thermodynamically unstable in the air. Therefore, you'll have some sort of, you start off with air and alcohol, you finish up with CO2. And this, if you start out with bio alcohol, every molecule of carbon dioxide has been taken in from the air by photosynthesis to make this. Now, normally in chemistry, how do you make two things react? If you want to get saponification, or you want something to react, you'll cook it up, you'll boil it, reflux it together. In other words, you get over the activation energy peak, assuming that what you're doing is an exothermic reaction. So what happens when you're actually boiling something, you're heating things together? You raise it to a higher vibrational states, or if you expose it to sunlight in the good old days, or UV, you'll either raise it to higher vibrational states, or you'll break bonds and get free radicals. Now, what happens in an ozonide? You expose the oxygen in the air to a very intense electric field, which involves very little flow of electricity. So you can, and the et cetera here is really important. I did not put in the et cetera.
Right.
We have several papers using sinusal discharge or an electric field. So that is one of the methods we are using here, an electric field. Mm-hmm. It's the same as a field effect transistor or a chemFET, a field effect transistor, which is a sensor for some airborne, say, impurity. And you can alter the chemistry of your sensor part by the strength of an electric field, which one does constantly in any electronic equipment as a transistor. So this is one of the things that really up our sleeve at the moment, is the et cetera there, which I didn't want to put into transparency. But the et cetera refers to here is an electric field. So an electric field then, in the sinusal electric discharge, where you pass air through an ozonizer, or you smell the ozone when you're using a Xerox machine, you're not breaking the bonds, you're getting the oxygen to go to a higher vibrational level, so that then you get a vibrationally activated O2 molecule can react either with another vibrationally excited O2 molecule or with a ground state O2 molecule, going from a singlet or triplet oxygen. So an electric field then, if you have a discharge, then you can get breaking of bonds. We're not interested in breaking of bonds, we're interested in using an electric field. We're now 35,000 volts at a few, not milliamps, but even smaller, microamps. No current flowing, hardly at all, but a very high electric field. I feel it's an enormous future type of reaction. We've been using quite a lot in the old textbook, which we got through interlibrary loan. It was published in, I think, 1960 or 1950, referring back to papers of 50 years before. Now we can look at some of this old stuff. We have newer types of apparatus, newer types of detection, so that I feel that the use of an electric field here, this is one of the things we feel is here in driving a car, to activate the air, the oxygen in the air, or activate the alcohol. Then people say, yeah, but you're putting in energy into the ozonizer. I say, sure, but years, and either we had just bought a conventional one, is 200 watts. You know, if you think of the headlights in these cars down here, you think of a 60 watt light bulb. We're talking about the energy of 200 to 100 watt light bulbs, and any of the cars going. Sure, you use energy to start the car. You use energy when you're driving it at night for headlights and tail lights. You use energy to drive the electric motor that circulates air. So in other words, you put in some energy, but all of the energy is created by the gasoline. The energy to either make the lights go or the engines go. Similarly, I believe, you know, you can have a fuel cell running from this. We haven't produced one yet, but everything looks, everything that Picardo has done so far is moves in the right direction. And yeah, we'll need to expend some energy in order to go this activation energy peak. But if they automobiles, you expend some energy for all the electrical stuff. So that is right now where we have to spend the next 10 years in involving this whole silent electric discharge aspect, and this whole new energy area. Because the energy, I think, when I first started off, material science was the buzzword. Then, more recently, nanotechnology, which is still a fascinating field, but I feel the big field now is energy. Not necessarily bioenergy, but energy, windmills, photoelectrolysis, water, etc., etc. Life is fun.
Right. Well, you were talking about fads and research questions. What had changed between the original synthesis of sulfur nitride, polysulfur nitride, and when you and Heger took up the question again? What questions had changed? What had made it an interesting topic?
That's a good point. Market Becker Goring in the early 1950s at Heidelberg had shown this high conductivity. Not as high as what he found. But, so what? He was interested in conductivity. Mm-hmm. Then I think one of the key things that developed was TTF, TCNQ. Are you familiar with that at all? Tetrathiophilbulene, tetracycline, TTF plus dot TCNQ minus dot. TCNQ, tetracycline, dimethane. So this then picks up an electron to be a neutral radical anion, TDF, tetrathioglobulin, can't quite remember the formula. But that this tends to lose electrons very easily, and it's an organic salt. So if you take a solution tetrathioglobulene and equimolar solution of these two organic solvents, mix them together, then you'll get crystals of this composition. Mm-hmm. And some of the crystals, and the crystals can have high electrical conductivities. So this then sparked a lot of interest, and so Heger was involved in looking at this across in the physics department. So sparked, what gradually sparked the interest, I think the feeling was probably that organic compounds having charge transfer salts having high conductivity, that the interest started to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
Inorganic. People, I think, were always thinking of inorganic, okay, you have sodium chloride, electrons and ionic conductivity and electronic conductivity all sort of mixed up together.
Uh-huh.
Whereas an organic compounds have high conductivity, then that's very, very much more interesting than an inorganic compound having high conductivity. So the TDF-TCNQ area, and there were some indications that Alan Heger had published a paper suggesting some superconducting fluctuations in this.
Uh-huh.
And there was a huge amount of controversy about that. And then a paper came out in PISCHEM Rev, well, with 30 different authors, ganged up, unfortunately, against Heger, and so that it did not go superconducting.
So was it that molecules provided a way to expand and complexify the study of electron transport? Was that the motivation then? That you were moving from simpler materials to these more complicated organics?
Right. I think the main thought was that the driving force was the whole physics community. How could you possibly have electrical transport of a metallic type,
mm-hmm,
in an organic material?
Uh-huh.
Just a crazy thought. It's just against anything known in the area of physics before.
Uh-huh.
I think this was the key thing. One can imagine having ionic conductivity, but having electronic. I know when we first published on the polyacetylene, there was one very nice letter to the editor in CNN News that said that these people are looking at either very high ionic conductivity or capacitance effects, because one is dealing with a lot of small fibrils and you've got large surface to volume ratio. So one is just dealing with capacitance effects.
Mm-hmm.
So
tell me about this process of working with Heger and developing a collaboration where you learned his language and he learned your language. What was involved in that?
I didn't catch.
What was involved in that process? I mean, were you hiring physicists in your lab, and was he hiring chemists in his lab, or were you having lunches together?
One of the key things was that we arranged to get together every Saturday morning.
Okay.
And we said we would not discuss a manuscript of a paper, we would not discuss research proposals. Just get there to smoke cigarettes and have coffee and let our minds wander,
mm-hmm,
which we could do. So it was mainly, very much, I think, getting together on Saturday mornings. Very few, telephones not ringing, and just saying, okay, let's talk. What is this dangling bonds in the band gap and non-bonding molecular orbitals? I know that Heger was talking about dangling bonds in the band gap. I said, I haven't any idea what you mean. He said, well, you've got your band gap here, conduction band and valence band, and valence band. And he said, well, then he wrote down some equation on the backboard, it means that this is a mid-gap state, and it can have electrons in it. And I said, well, if it's got electrons in it, sounds like a non-bonding molecular orbit. If this is the pi antibonding, this is the pi bonding, this is halfway, then this is a pi non-bonding, halfway between bonding and antibonding. And then they would say, yes, you could say that. it's just for swapping chemistry ideas and physics ideas.
Uh-huh.
So there we both taught ourselves a little bit of each other's discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun.
What about the mechanics of experimentation? I mean, were materials going sort of directly from your lab to his lab?
So we'd make things in here,
mm-hmm.
And then the only trouble was we'd get some little bit of success, and he was, let's do something. We'd say, no, we want to make sure we can reproduce it. We measure it ourselves first to see if it's looking right. You see, we got onto the doping of poly acetylene in a very unexpected way. We got that in this backup system over here. On the side of this vacuum system here.
Uh-huh.
You might come down now.
Sure.
I'll show you something else here. Made some diversion of the acetylene. We made some diversions. This is the world's first anisotropic superconductor. These were made by these are all beautiful. They're really,
mm-hmm.
really delightful. Following work by Gillespie in Canada, we'd put a little bit of mercury here, and then we'd put liquefied SO2 gas in here, and then with arsenic pentafluoride gas, and then that would react going through this little capillary, that would then form a crystal which would grow out. And these had fallen off, they'd go out from here, standing upright. And but the key thing was we had arsenic pentafluoride gas in this, that back line, that side. That's over from this experiment. We made some digressions along the way, away from some of these things. These were some photos of some of these things growing here. You can see that little tube there,
mm-hmm.
and this is this crystal going out from the side. But these were all sort of digressions, various things going from that. It's an early stage of growth. Yeah, but now the key thing that we one of the really good dopants for polyacetylene, we were in the back lines at this time we had. We had grease stopcocks, same as you put on grease here, and grease absorbs acid and the fluoride gas.
Uh-huh.
We had some polyacetylene between two lasers on that side of the back line. We're pumping it down, and the conductivity, the resistance of the polyacetylene seemed to keep on increasing. This is crazy. Anyway, what we found out was that we'd be using the same backline that we're using this and we're passing pentafluoride and dissolved in the stopcock grease, and that it was back diffusion. And even though, so this was the backline here, so there's grease here, and we have the subcock here. And even though we're pumping out, you still get some acid pentafluoride. And then we had the polyacetylene here with contact. This was diffusing back and doping the polyacetylene,
mm-hmm.
Because we had traces of the acid pentafluoride remaining from the mercury compound.
Right.
A lot of these things sort of crop up. You wonder whether it's the apparatus or what.
Well, continuing on that, the sort of theme of serendipities, tell me about meeting up with Hideki Shirakawa and learning about polyacetylene. And
the most important cup of green tea I've ever had in my life. when I was a visiting professor at Kyoto University, I was asked to give a lecture at Tokyo Institute of Technology, and this was at the time on silicon work, and also it was a double barrel title, silicon work and polysulfur nitride. And Higa, as I found out later, didn't bother going to my lecture. After the lecture, I was invited to have a cup of green tea on the little tables and just about floor level at the head of the chemistry department. And Shirakawa, as a junior faculty member, was invited to join. And he was sitting on my left-hand side. But he joined because he was invited by the head of the department, but he didn't go to my lecture. So during having tea, I took out this sample of the polysulfur nitride. I think I've got this. Have you seen any of it?
No, I don't think I have.
This is way back. We were able to grow epitaxial films. This is in 1977. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought I had some. Maybe I've got these samples with him. Well, we won't bother. Sorry about that.
It's okay.
Anyway, that I showed, I was showing a sample of our polysulfur nitride, And then Shirakawa said, oh, I have something like that, but it's silvery. And I said, oh, I'd love to see it. So he left the green tea table, went back to the lab, and brought in the sample of this polyacetylene. And I said, what's that? He said, polyacetylene. And since I was not an organic chemist, I said, what's the formula of polyacetylene? And so he said, oh, it's just, you get it by polymerizing acetylene, which is CH or twice, and it goes to a polymer just using a zeolite catalyst. And I said, well, what's the conductivity? It's bright and shiny. And, oh, and he said, it's about 10 to the minus 5 siemens per centimeter, sort of, semiconductor. So I said, oh, that's interesting. He said, if I can get some money, could you spend a year with us? Mm-hmm. And that's why I wrote to Kimber and said, get this for a postdoc, and he came over. And the more we had some zeolite catalyst, aluminum oxide, TiO2, titanium dioxide present as ash when we did a carbon-hydrogen analysis. The carbon-hydrogen analysis was about, together was about 90%, but of course it should be 100%. So we decided, right in this lab here, that we get it sufficiently washed, wash out the zeolite catalyst. So we washed and got it better and better, and we got the conductivity closer and closer, got it up to about 98.6. The purer we got it, the smaller was the conductivity. And he said, this is crazy, when you purify something, the conductivity goes up. And then thought, aha, maybe the titanium and aluminum catalyst impurity are acting as dopants, mm-hmm. making the conductivity higher. So so that was the key thing. We found the purer it got, the smaller was the conductivity. And then before then, we'd published on this, we found that the SNX plus bromine vapor would give SNBr 0.4x, and that raised the conductivity about by one order of magnitude to the conductivity of iron. So we thought, okay, let's see if we can use the same dopant we'd used for SNX. And we did that, and the conductivity shot right through the roof. And then they came to this arsenic tetrafluoride, which gave an even higher mm-hmm. conductivity.
So you'd already been thinking of dopants before then, before you got to the polyacetylene?
We'd done that we'd use bromine on the SNX,
right,
which we published on this, getting up to about the conductivity of iron, mm-hmm. About an order of magnitude increase. Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't automatic to think about doping with the polyacetylene until after you had tried these purification experiments?
No, that is correct. Uh-huh. Because we found the more pure we made it, the smaller was the conductivity.
Mm-hmm. And was Heger involved immediately with the polyacetylene work as well?
No, only when we found that, because we developed our own technique for measuring conductivities with SNX, but then when we got into the polyacetylene, then he had very much better equipment. He could measure the change in conductivity with change in temperature. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to see then whether it had the temperature profile of a metal or of a semiconductor. And so if it were a metal, if you measure the conductivity as you decrease the temperature, the conductivity should increase. If it's a metal, if it's a semiconductor, it should decrease. Mm-hmm. So measuring the the conductivity temperature profile is very, very important. And so he had all the apparatus set up, and then he was very much better versed we had no experience in magnetic properties, and so he was able to measure magnetic properties as well.
Uh-huh.
And so then we got going, and also, of course, very, very, very good knowledge of the conduction processes and band structure in metals.
Tell me a little about your own experience moving into organic chemistry with the polyacetylene. Was that a shock at all? Did you have to learn kind of a whole new vocabulary?
Well, the only organic chemistry I'd ever had in my life, formally, I think it was just one course in New Zealand on introduction to organic chemistry. So, but I found that the real thing is the challenge of learning,
mm-hmm.
puzzling over things, asking questions.
Mm-hmm. Was Shirakawa helpful in that sense? I mean, being here and being here?
He was good. Mm-hmm. He was trained as a polymer mm-hmm. chemist. So he was very, very helpful. But I found really the interaction with the students in the group, I really shouldn't call them students because I call them teachers.
Right.
I've learned so much from them. Indeed, in this whole thing in agri-energy, Picato, originally from Brazil, went to him. I would know very, very little about this whole heavy energy stuff.
Right.
So I just find that I learn from everyone. And also, as I say, I've made thousands of mistakes in the past. I hope to live sufficiently long to make thousands more in the future. But I love the learning.
What was some of the reaction to the famous 1977 paper on doping of polyacetylene?
Yeah, actually, it's sort of rather interesting. For about 15-20 years, being a physicist, myself as a chemist, were taken as mavericks. You couldn't believe anything we said.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I was anything with reports from myself. Well, this is a chemist, a bungling chemist who doesn't know anything about physics. Heger was considered to be way out of his depth. He worked on magnetism for his PhD, as I recall. It's magnetism. He was considered as being way out of his depth, and he had lost a lot of face by talking about superconducting fluctuations in TDFT and DCNQ. So we were not believed by the physics group. We were not believed by the synthesis group. Did not belong to any standard group of people.
Mm-hmm.
People would ask us along to give talks at ACS and APS meetings. It's sort of amusing, listening to these guys with all their crazy thoughts. But we were really not accepted
mm-hmm.
by any group. It really is funny. It was only after we got a Nobel Prize that we were offered to join the Academy, that we're cold-shouldered by everyone. and then more and more people started getting interested,
mm-hmm.
and more people started getting similar results. So slowly, then people started feeling, well, maybe there's something about these people the same.
But there must have been some small community around that at least responded to this work in some way, right?
Mm-hmm. The staunch small community, Joel Miller, who's at the University of Utah, was always a good staunch supporter. Yeah, there was a group of persons who felt that this was true, and they had was sufficiently interested to repeat work themselves. But so there was a small group which kept growing, a small support group that kept growing and growing.
Right. How did those people find each other? Were they coming through you and then meeting each other, or
Right? Or we had a small group on every year on ICSM, International Synthetic Metal group. And this group grew. It's been going now for 15 years or so. It meets every 2 years or 20 years. ICSM, International Conference on Synthetic Metals. And every year they grew more and more. It does not belong to any official organization. Every time we have a meeting, every 2 years, we have a meeting of the International Advisory Committee, and there are always two groups of people from different countries that will say that we'd like to be host for the next meeting. And it's grown and grown and grown, and more people came in constantly. So it started with a few believers, the disciples, which then became bigger and bigger and bigger with every passing year. And people would come, a lot of people would come out of curiosity to some of these ICSM meetings. They would hear the presentations, and sometimes some of them would do experiments themselves, others would tell more, and more and more and more and more people came to these meetings. I think we started off this one in Boulder, Colorado, or in Utah, Salt Lake City with Joel Miller. I think there were about 150 people. And the last one, I think was in somewhere in Scandinavia, there were about 1,500 papers and about 2,000 or 1,500 or more people.
At what point did people from industry become interested in possible technological applications? I mentioned a couple companies in the email, particularly Xerox and 3M, have worked with this, right?
Right. Xerox through Joel Miller. And Joel Miller was employed by Xerox. A very far-sighted person. Apparently Xerox, I don't know how official this is or not, equipment have used polypyrrole conducting polymers in Xerox equipment for years and years, at Joel Miller's suggestions. That in the drum it builds up an electrostatic pattern, and then how to get rid of it. They did have metal brushes, a couple wires, but the copper mechanically abraded the drum. So then I believe Joel Miller then suggested putting in polypyrrole fibers, conducting polypyrrole, an organic polymer instead of a metal, which did not mechanically harm the drum, but was still was sufficiently conducting to remove the electrostatic charge pattern from the drum. There was a lot of slowly growing, a lot of people at the beginning, a lot of companies thought, oh, we could use this as a substitute for copper wire. But the conductivity was not really high enough, and the stability not sufficiently good. this field really burst wide open in 1993 with Richard Friend at Cambridge University, where he discovered electroluminescence. And that is by passing a small voltage, sort of around about 5 volts, plus or minus a few volts, up to about 10, across a film of the material would give out a visible radiation. And I believe this occurred by accident on a Sunday evening in Cambridge in winter when it gets dark early. And a postdoc or graduate school student by the name of Burridge was measuring some phenomenon with a piece of polyphenylene, polyphenylene, vinylene, and he had, I think, you know, just a few volts, maybe 10 volts attached across the some film. And he came into the lab, I guess, to check it one Sunday evening, and it was dark. And it opened the door, and this is the story, I don't know how true it is, opened the door, and before he flicked on the light, he saw a sort of a green light from up there, and he flicked on the light and didn't see any place it could be green light, so he flicked it off again, and sort of walked towards the green light, and found that it was this film that was glowing, and walked back and flicked on the light, and I have no idea what experiment he was trying to measure on it. But that was the beginning of electroluminescence.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, the whole electroluminescent field in for colored electroluminescence, one has either conducting polymers, which with a few volts, electricity across them can give off different colors according to what electronic polymer, and also organic molecular compounds that can be sublimed on. So there are two types of electroluminescent materials that are looked at very, very extensively, both for LEDs from point of view of automobile brake lights, or now coming in more and more for stop lights,
right,
for big flat screen. Kodak has got some very nice work, big flat keeps flat screen LEDs, very much better than liquid crystal ones, because liquid crystal, if you get at a certain angle, you can't see it, whereas with an LED cell phone, you can turn it almost at right angles to your plane of vision, and you can still see the lettering. So I think this whole episode of electroluminescence really got the field going in interest by industry. However, people also laughed because they said, well, the electroluminescence as presently observed in electronic polymers lasts in the air for, I don't know, a few minutes or an hour or two, and so the liquid crystal people felt they were completely safe because they'd never be of any commercial use. But now I think you can get electroluminescent material operating for about 40,000 hours. And then also in the whole area of photovoltaics, conversion of sunlight to electricity, the thought then, rather than using silicon solar panels, to have big sheets of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
So that is now, a lot of work has been done on photovoltaics from the point of view of sunlight conversion to electricity. So, and the efficiency has been constantly increasing, still not good enough for commercial use, but I'm sure it will come. Now people are looking forward to electronic clothing,
right?
With flexible material, and have electronic clothing, photovoltaic cells to charge, capacitors. So this is sort of another step forward, is the whole aspect of electronic clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I think one of the things that one cannot underplay is the enormous importance of industry. Once industry sort of feels maybe they've got a new product, they will stick at it and see what the problems are and overcome the problems. For example, one of the key things is getting a good shield against atmospheric, against the air, both oxygen and water vapor. So one of the very big advances has been in the electroluminescence, is getting a good non-pervious mm-hmm. shield to stop air diffusing in.
Right.
And various approaches have been used here to have, if you've got any pinholes in the films, to have several layers of films, so the chances are if air diffuses through one, it'll float around the floor, finds another pinhole to go through, so it slows down the diffusion process, as well as better chemicals to better polymers to eliminate air diffusion through it. But if one looks back over conventional plastics, the role of plasticizers in partly in many polymers has converted the polymer from a relatively useless technological polymer to something which can be really useful by the use of plastics. So I think the input of industry is extraordinarily important, because they will push things where they see.
Now the Naval Research Lab was an early supporter, right? Fred Salfeld set up an electro.
Right, Fred Salfeld was magnificent.
Tell me a little about the consultation with them. I mean, you went down there fairly frequently.
Not frequently, quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Both my wife and I got to know Fred and his wife very mm-hmm. well. We'd go out, and stay with them overnight in Washington. We'd go out to some show mm-hmm. at night. And then we got to know Fred and his wife very, very much indeed. So, and then of course he was very ill for several months in a coma. And then he retired about a year, 18 months ago.
Uh-huh. But tell me a little about that Electroactive Polymers group. I mean, were they really trying to take your ideas and move them into Navy relevant applications quickly, or?
One of the other thoughts was whether one could use this for transmission of information through sonic waves underwater,
uh-huh.
which could be then directional. So. In other words, there are certain ceramic ones, I forget, is it barium titanate possibly, that has an interesting sort of piezoelectric effect where you can put in also field, and mechanically you'll get a deformation, and this can be directed through water. Transmit information underwater in a directional mode. So from the point of view of an enemy, then that's a site we can find out. Also, other aspects from the point of view of anti-fouling in naval vessels.
Mm-hmm.
The thought is that various types of conductive paints which you could hold them at a certain potential, would discourage radical growth.
Right.
None of these have turned out to be very, none of them, to the best of my knowledge, have turned out to be successful.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of interest in this area.
Mm-hmm.
I would say lots of feeling this direction and that direction, but the inhibition of radical growth, which cost the Navy a huge amount of money, both in slowing down the rate at which a vessel can sail, and also the fact which used more fuel, and also it's when it's out of commission to get the barnacles and dry bark removed. And the tin compounds, of course, act as good defouling agents, but they're not permitted on domestic vessels, but the Navy can still use them.
Yeah.
So, no, I would say the key things at the moment, electroluminescent displays, flat screen displays in different colors, photovoltaic coming up the home straight, and various types of scanning. Of conducting polymer scanners that Higa has done some very, very beautiful work in. So electronics, definitely number one. Photovoltaics, a lot of interest. Photovoltaics of various types of conducting polymers, and porphyrin as the absorber of various metalloporphyrins as energy collectors, and also carbon nanotubes and polythiophene, regular polythiophene carbon nanotubes. Photovoltaics. A small company has just been started in Texas on that within the last couple of weeks. So that is coming up real well. And from the point of view of color scanners, scanning colored material, real interesting possibilities, I think, with various types of electronic polymers.
Mm-hmm.
My own feeling at the moment is that the whole area of electronic polymers is going to be industry driven, and in so doing, new scientific phenomena will be discovered.
Uh-huh.
But it will be industry driven. Which I think is great.
I noticed in a lot of the apparatus you were showing me from the 70s that you were making batteries and storage devices with these polymers. Was that meant to demonstrate an industrial application or merely to show off some of the characteristics?
The key thing is we put in some early papers was to demonstrate, surprisingly, that organic polymers could act as storage material for electricity, and that the charge, stored charge, could be liberated on demand at a sufficiently high rate of power that it could be useful for something.
Uh-huh.
Other than the